Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and thank you for listening to the Wise Women Media Radio Show. And that is one of my favorite pieces of music, Vivaldi's Spring, and I thought it was quite fitting to play that tonight. I hope everybody has had a wonderful spring equinox. It just seems very appropriate to play that song and think about what's growing in the garden. I've had several seeds come up this week. I wanted to do a show about gardening. I'm sure we'll get to that within the next couple of weeks. And I had some issues getting a guest that could come on tonight. So since I wasn't successful, I thought I would play a special presentation of Permaculture and the Sacred, A Conversation with Starhawk. Starhawk, as you know, is a contemporary witch, activist, and permaculturist. She spoke at the Harvard Divinity School on March 7th, just earlier this month, about how earth-based spirituality can inform and empower efforts to build sustainable communities and societies. Starhawk is also the founder of Reclaiming, a contemporary pagan tradition that blends goddess spirituality, social activism, and earth activist trainings. All of that equips people to combine permaculture design with political organizing and spiritual practice. A leading interpreter of feminist Wicca, she is the author of The Spiral Dance, The Fifth Sacred Thing, The Empowerment Manual, and many other books. The Spiral Dance actually is one of the first pagan books I ever read, and I encourage everyone to read The Fifth Sacred Thing, which is also being made into a movie. And you'll find a lot of parallels from that book, which was written in the early 90s, to our present-day society. So without further ado, I'm going to start the audio feed for this. And if you have any questions in the meantime or you have something you would like to say, we are scheduled for 2 hours. The runtime for this is an hour and 24 minutes. I'd be happy to stop the feed and address any questions or call-ins. This is an open mic and a mic check, so this show belongs to you, and it's supposed to give you, the listener, the floor if there's an issue that you would like to speak about. So tuning this up now, and enjoy.
Such a pleasure to be here, to be speaking in this historic place, and also to have gotten a chance to see some of the wonderful efforts that Harvard and the Divinity School are making towards greening and recycling and composting. I even did a little tour of the garden, though it was perhaps not the best season here. On the other hand, coming from California, where it's spring now and things are blooming and it's, you know, not to make you eat your heart out, but just to say, if you're a farmer or gardener in California, you never get a break. There's no downtime. So sometimes I envy you who live in the snow for that lovely season of being able to turn inward and look out at the garden and go, you know, there's nothing I can do today. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the intersection of the sacred, the spiritual, and the ecological. And to say, I'm going to be talking a bit about permaculture, which is a whole system of ecological design. And one of the things that we talk about in permaculture is the concept of edges, or in biology they call them ecotones, the places where two different systems meet are places of great dynamism. They can be places of great tension, but they can also be the most creative, most diverse aspects that kind of create a third system that is often richer than either of the other two. So if you are out there looking to find the deer don't hang out in the deep, deep forest, and they don't live out in the middle of the plains. What they really like are those places where the meadow meets the woods, where they can go out to graze and go back into the forest for cover. And if you're looking at something like the ocean, where the ocean meets the shore, there are all these tremendous places of great richness and diversity and vitality, because that connection of those two systems creates so many different niches where different forms of life can live. I often think of that in terms of systems of thought, that when you bring together something like spirituality, ecology, politics, you can create a rich edge that can be sometimes richer than any of those systems can be alone. So that's kind of where I'm coming from today. And I wanted to begin by just giving you a little background on myself and sort of how I got into this particular combination of things. I came out of the early feminist movement in the late 60s and early 70s. I had been raised Jewish and brought up with a pretty strong Jewish education and background, but that was the 60s, where everybody was experimenting with all kinds of different spiritualities, where one of the interesting edges at that time that people were exploring was an edge where Eastern spirituality met Western spirituality, many different kinds of exciting revolutions in thought, not to mention the revolutions in politics, and of course always sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which are a certain kind of spiritual practice all of their own. And out of that mix, I started to become aware that for me as a young woman at that time in Judaism, there was sort of nowhere to go with my education. There were, I'm talking like 66, 67, there were no women rabbis or cantors or spiritual leaders, but I didn't even have like the inkling of a thought in my mind that such a thing was possible. I wasn't even in rebellion about it. It just wasn't even on my radar screen. My mother was always in rebellion. She was always saying, oh, my brothers got bar mitzvah and I didn't, and I was so angry about it. And I was like, oh, Mom, that was a long time ago. You know, that was ancient history. Get over it, right? Many years later, we were able to come back together. I'm like, you were right, Mom. But as I began reading and learning and thinking about feminism, one of the things that started to become apparent to us in those days of exploration was how much religion and religious concepts and our concepts of God and the sacred determined our social relationships. And reinforce the idea both that men were supposed to be in power over women, but also were connected to a whole series of metaphors deeply embedded in our language around how goodness and value was associated with things that are high and light and white and outside of the world. And things that were dark and down and dirty and embodied were devalued. And you can, you can see that when we talk about dirt. I'm going to, here at Harvard Divinity School, I'm going to show you dirty pictures. And yet without dirt, we don't live, you know, right? Those metaphors, I think, are also deeply reinforced racism as well as other kinds of divisions. They reinforce a kind of classism because people who work with their hands or work with the dirt or do actual physical things or tend bodies or tend children are devalued compared to people who work with abstractions and manipulate things that don't actually exist. We can definitely see that right now in our financial crisis operating very heavily. So we started to develop that critique in the 70s, and some of us started looking and saying, was there ever anything else? Well, I happen to know that there was something else because back when in my first freshman year at UCLA, a friend of mine and I had done an anthropology project on witches. And we had run into some people who were actually practicing what they told us was this tradition, this religion that had survived from before Judaism, before Christianity, that was the old pagan, shamanic, earth-based spirituality of Europe and the Middle East. And we kind of went, wow, that's really cool. Started learning, started practicing, eventually kind of drifted away from that original group of people. But in terms of the feminist movement, I was like, you know, there's a religion that says there's a goddess that says earth is sacred, nature is sacred, that says sexuality is sacred, women's bodies are sacred, that says me, you know, as a young woman, there are no barriers to my moving forward and taking leadership. And to me, this has something to do with feminism. Well, not too many other people thought that at the time, because most feminist thinkers and writers seemed to feel that religion was the opiate of the people and was inherently oppressive. But I did meet some others. There was a woman in L.A. named Dee Budapest who had a shop called the Feminist Wicca, who had carried on a tradition that had come to her through her family tradition in Hungary. I moved to the Bay Area, I met other people, and we began learning and practicing and experimenting. And because a lot of us who came together were political activists from the 60s or feminists from the 70s, we practiced our religion in a context that said, you know, hey, if we really believe the earth is sacred, we can't just sit back and let idiots destroy her. We have to do something about it. So part of our spiritual religious practice must be engagement with these great political and environmental struggles of the time. And if we believe that every human being is an embodiment of the goddess of the sacred, then we can't just sit back and let some people oppress others. You know, we have to be involved in these great social justice struggles of our time. And I'm proud to say that many of us in reclaiming have been, from that time onward, involved in many, many, many different struggles and issues around social justice, peace, and environmental issues. So, time went on, and sometime in the late 80s, in the early 90s, I met up with a friend who had just taken a course in something called permaculture. And she started telling me about a whole system of ecological design that was based on the idea that if we can observe nature and figure out how nature is working and work in the same way that nature works, we can actually create systems that will meet our human needs while actually regenerating the environment around us instead of destroying it. And I got very interested in that. I thought this is the practical application of the idea that the earth is sacred. And eventually was able to take a permaculture design course myself and begin teaching it. Permaculture is a system that was originated by two Australians, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, back in the 70s. Bill was teaching at the University of Tasmania. David was one of his graduate students. They were running around in these amazing Tasmanian rainforests, looking at these incredible ecological systems, and they start to ask the question, how come nobody has to manage this forest? How does this forest take care of itself? Nobody comes out here and prunes it. Nobody sprays the bugs. Nobody plants the seeds. And yet this is one of the richest ecosystems on the planet. If we look at it, if we observe it, if we understand how it's working, could we apply those same principles to human systems? And if we could do that, could we, instead of having a kind of agriculture that is tremendously destructive to the land, could we develop an agriculture that would be a permanent agriculture, like a forest is a permanent system, that would be self-sustaining, that wouldn't require so many inputs, both of human energy and fossil fuel energy and other kinds of energy. So out of that, they developed the system of permaculture, which originally was focused agriculture and food growing systems and land management, and still very much is. But in recent years, many people have taken it and said, you know, if we understand some of these principles and patterns, we can actually apply them to things like social permaculture, to things like human systems, living systems, economies, as well as ecologies, and permaculture, instead of being permanent agriculture, has kind of come to mean permanent culture. And now permaculture is pretty much a worldwide movement with a lot of diversity within it. In many, many, many countries throughout the world, we think permaculture has more on-the-ground projects around the world than the UN does. And people have been doing some amazing things with it. You know, there are some amazing permaculture people who are doing things like Jeff Lawton, sort of Bill Mollison, who runs the Pink Permaculture Research Institute in Australia, was talking recently about completely revitalizing a desiccated area in China the size of Belgium and regenerating it and bringing it back to Cuba. After the Soviet Union collapsed and cut off basically their access to oil and to supplies, adopted permaculture and used it to make a transition to organic agriculture, locally based system. It allowed them not only to survive, but actually to thrive and to improve their health and their economy. So there are many, many different ways that permaculture is out there working in the world. And I think permaculture as a system has a lot of lessons for us right now in this very crucial time where essentially we are up against the need because of climate change to make radical shifts in the way that we do things. Small things like changing our economy, our technology, our food growing systems, right? Our lighting, our heating, you know, just a few things, right? And oftentimes I think that people look at that and get overwhelmed and despairing about this immense need that we face and the little that we're actually capable of doing about it. Now, I'm going to assume that I don't have to persuade you A, that climate change is real, or B, that we need to do something about it, or C, that things are bad. Because I have limited time and I don't really want to spend it trying to make that case. I think that case is being made all around us. What I want to talk about are what are the shifts that we need to make and what are some of the guiding principles and practices that could lead us through to make that change. And to say that of all those immense things that we need to do and change, what they really come back to, I think, is an underlying shift in our way of looking at the world. A shift from looking at the world as a bunch of dead, isolated objects to looking at the world as a living web of relationships. To me, that is the core insight of earth-based spirituality. It is also what indigenous cultures have always maintained and continue to maintain and continue to try to tell us whenever they have a voice that they are able to speak to us about. And it's also kind of basic common sense that we are in relationship to the environment around us, that we cannot destroy our environment and expect to have healthy, fulfilled lives. And that the longer we wait to do something about this crisis, the fewer resources we will have to do it with. So, looking to that, I think permaculture and earth-based spirituality converge around this understanding, deep understanding, that everything is in relationship. And along with that, I think, goes also a shift in our consideration of the sacred. That the sacred, when I say the sacred, I'm not thinking about, like, what is it we bow down to or what is it we put on a pedestal. What I'm thinking about is, what is it that's most important to us? What is it that we value beyond our personal comfort, our convenience? Sacred and sacrifice have the same root. So what is it we are willing to take a stand for, to take a risk for? What is it we care about so much that we don't want to compromised or tainted or polluted in some way? And we come out of these sort of by God traditions for the past 1,000 years that have located the sacred outside the world, and many of them have told us this world itself kind of is just not worth much. Now, I will say in every single one, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all of those traditions, Buddhism, Hinduism, there are also strong strands of ecological wisdom and strong ethical strands that say, no, actually, this world is important and you need to take care of it and it's part of our religion. But too often, I think that sense of this world being devalued is what actually plays out in our culture, and particularly because in recent times, that has shifted from the value not even being the value of God or heaven or some other world, but being this other abstract value of profit on the balance sheet. And so we are willing to destroy our forests for somebody's set of numbers. We are willing to compromise the integrity of our groundwater for somebody else's set of numbers. Are willing to continue to pump our atmosphere full of carbon dioxide, again, for some other abstract set of numbers. And I think one of the great works that we can do as people who are concerned with the sacred is to counter that and to talk about that as a question of values and a question of deep morals and ethics and say, actually, no, we don't have the right to destroy the systems that support our lives, the systems that our children and grandchildren will depend on for their future, the living systems that support other forms of life, or an abstraction that really has no essential value or meaning of its own. This is like a great ensorcelment, you know, that has been spell placed on the world, you know, to make us believe that somehow or other there is any kind of sense at all in placing profit above the living systems of the earth. To do that effectively, I think it's helpful for us to know what to counter it with in a positive way, not to just be able to say this is wrong and this is crazy, but what would it look like if we had a sane set of values? And to me, that's where comes in. So I wanted to not just talk about it, but also show you some pictures of it, because I think permaculture is photogenic. So I don't know if there's a way to dim some of the lights, if that'll work with the recording or whatever, but hopefully you can all see what's up there. So permaculture. Oh, great. So what world do we want? I'll take a show of hands. Who wants the world on the left? Who wants the world on the right? Okay. A world of poverty, which is what billions of people live in today, is a direct result of this combination of ecological devastation and social injustice. Or a world of abundance. So permaculture is a system of ecological design that shows us how we can create human systems modeled after natural systems. And permaculture has three core ethics: care for the earth, care for people, and to me, I think this is, again, another place where earth-based spirituality and permaculture and indigenous wisdom come together. You know, sometimes in the environmental movement, you'll meet these people who seem to believe that human beings are a blight on the planet, and that the planet would be better off without us, and we're in the process of wiping ourselves out, and maybe that's all for the best. I actually don't believe that. I actually believe we're here for a reason, and that the Earth went to a lot of trouble to evolve our big brains and opposable thumbs, and species, like they're rooting for us to figure out how to use them. I also think it's an impossible idea to organize and mobilize people around. You just cannot inspire people to take action around the premise that everything is better off if they were dead. But I think that modern environmentalists, permaculturalists, and I think this has been part of indigenous wisdom throughout the ages, understand that people are part of the earth. And that to heal ecological systems, human intervention and human wisdom can be useful. And then also to take care of people, to really create systems of justice and abundance that are going to meet human needs, we absolutely have to take care of the earth, because we aren't living on some outer space station. You know, we aren't on Battlestar Galactica hurtling through the galaxies. We are living on the earth. And if we don't take care of the earth, we won't continue to do so. So those two things are inextricably combined and are the core ethics, I think, both of permaculture but also of earth-based spirituality and of any real sane ethical system. And the third is often framed in different ways, but I like the way they speak about it in Africa, the African permaculture movement, as care for the future. It's our responsibility to look to the future and to realize that we do not have the right to use up the resources today, to spoil the earth today without any consideration of the generations that come after us. And in order to do that, we need to share the surplus, reinvest the surplus. We do permaculture right when the earth is healthy. She produces abundance, but that abundance needs to go back into the systems that continue to create. And that also means reducing our consumption. Some people call this one fair share. That way it rhymes with people care, earth care, fair share. But to me, this is also the social justice principle that I don't think movements are very effective if they essentially tell people what we often do tell people on the left, social justice movements, which is a story that says, things are worse than you thought, and it's probably your fault. And if they're going to get better at all, it's going to require you to make enormous sacrifices. And if you don't do that, you're a bad person. That's not really a winning strategy. But in permaculture, what we say is, okay, things are worse than we thought, but they could be better than we have ever imagined if we approach them with ethics and with smarts. And to do that, it will require shifts and changes. But it will ultimately create a world of abundance for everybody that's going to make us all happier, healthier, and allow us to continue to pass that on to generations to come. And that, I think, is something worth working for and worth struggling for and worth fighting for. So permaculture also has a set of principles. How we go about working. And ultimately, that core principle, I think of it as the one that says design relationships, not just separate, isolated objects. I think that is part of a shift we've been going through culturally for a long time now. It's a shift that has been happening in science. It's not even 21st century science, it's like early 20th century physics. They start to go deeper and deeper into the atom and look at, what is the ultimate particle of stuff in the universe? How do we get to the smallest little bit of stuff there is? And when they got down to the smallest little bit of stuff there was, they found there was no stuff there. There was nothing but waveforms that they couldn't even tell were waves or particles. Now they think they're strings vibrating in great harmonies of the universe. They were waves of probability, and that view of physics, you know, again, it's been around now for 100 years. It's not even a new view of physics. It has yet to shift our cultural view completely, but it is there at the basis of the way we understand science. A lot of different scientific traditions, from ecology, which is really the study of relationships in systems theories, and understandings that underlie things like computer systems and the World Wide Web and the kinds of technologies that we have started to evolve, all come out of the shift from looking at isolated stuff to looking at relationships. And part of looking at relationships is also looking at patterns. I want to show you just a little piece of the video that we created about permaculture called The Growing Edge, that I did with my friend Donna Reed Cooper, who's a wonderful director. Technological. All right, doesn't like the video, so we'll just keep with the PowerPoint. It's the mysteries of technology. Probably should have like burned some incense to it before we started. Right. Yeah. So I will say this about pattern. In permaculture, we look at patterns. We look at core patterns, like the way that nature uses certain patterns over and over again, like the branching patterns that are the same in a leaf or a tree or a river system or the veins in your body. We look at that and say, why is that pattern used again and again? What does it do? And when you look at what it does, you realize that it's a pattern of flow, of two-way flow. And it's a pattern for filling space, a pattern for absorbing, for gathering in and concentrating and dispersing. And that's why it works in your blood and why it works in the river, in a leaf. And when we understand how those patterns work, then we can understand how to use them and employ them in design. I also think that looking at patterns is something that is part of, again, that shift from looking at things as isolated objects and looking at things as relationships. When we look at patterns in art, culture, patterns in sculpture, you'll see, if you look at early works of art, you'll see that these same patterns that we work with in permaculture, the branching pattern, the spiral, the wave, the meander, the radial pattern, are used over and over and over again in art. And one of the thinkers, scholars who looked at this in terms of the old goddess religions was Maria Gimbutas. She was the director of the Department of Indo-European Studies at UCLA for many years. She actually was here at Harvard for a time because she was an immigrant from Lithuania who came to the U.S. after the war. Her husband was working in Boston, and she was, Harvard allowed her to be an unpaid fellow here for a while to research. Because she was one of the few people who actually could read the archaeological reports coming from Eastern Europe, because she spoke something like 15 different languages. But her work has been very influential in the goddess movement in looking back at some of the early archaeological stuff that was pretty much ignored by archaeologists and anthropologists. And one of the things that she did was she looked at tremendous numbers of artifacts and looked at the patterns of the art and the archaeology. And out of that, she believed she could reconstruct some of the beliefs and understandings of these old European traditions. Now, there's always a lot of controversy about her work. And if anyone's interested in pursuing this more, ask me a question when we get to questions. Otherwise, I can rant on about it forever and ever. But I will say that I think really what the controversy goes down to is that she, again, was a pattern thinker and was looking at patterns and relationships. Archaeology went in a direction that said, no, you can't do that. You can only look at separate, isolated objects and their provenance and the material culture, and you can speculate. And I think for those of you who are scholars and thinkers, it's worth looking at that question in many different disciplines to say that idea that only the material is real and worth looking at is, in a sense, a belief system. It's a set of values we have voluntarily adopted, and it may not actually represent the most objective form of knowledge. It may not actually be a useful tool for looking at cultures that didn't think that way, saw things in terms of relationships, in terms of patterns, in terms of connections. Okay, so we're going to try one more time for the... So I'll just say this, too. To me, making the shift to permaculture is also a different kind of shift in terms of how we look at design. How many of you are gardeners? So how many of you have ever, like, gone to bed with gardener's porn? You know, something like the White Flower Farm catalog. Yeah! Yeah! And you look at that and you go, like, I've got to have that rose, you know, right? I've got to possess it. I've got to have it in my garden next to that lavender. You know? And... you know, it's easy to do that, and I admit that I fall into that, too. But when you go into permaculture, you start to look at things differently. You say, okay, it doesn't have to be, it's not so much that rose because it looks so pretty. If I'm looking at a rose, I'm looking at a set of relationships. So I'm going to look at the rose, and I'm going to say, all right, first of all, what are some of the qualities of a rose? Well, flowers, the flowers can attract bees and pollinators. But you know what? Probably that rose, that luscious one with 1,500 petals, no scent, it's so overbred, that probably isn't going to do anything for the pollinators. That much simpler rose, that's much closer. Oh, you got it. To an earlier, thank you. To an earlier rose, that one probably would. And a rose has thorns. So if I put this rose somewhere where those thorns are going to function, like instead of surrounding my urban garden in the inner city with barbed wire to keep out intruders, what if I planted climbing roses, much friendlier looking, but equally, probably more effective? What if I planted some lovely five-petal rose that's going to, rugosa, that's going to actually give me rose hips that are useful? Vitamin C, I might actually have a whole product out of this. And instead of just getting something that looks pretty, I'm getting something that serves multiple functions. And I do that by thinking about its relationships of time and space. And in doing that kind of thinking, you also help create abundance. Okay, so now hopefully we're going to hear a little from Maddie and look at a few patterns.
I wanted to stop the presentation there just to do a little station identification. We are the Wise Women Media radio show. We broadcast every Friday night at 10 o'clock. Usually our shows are either 1 hour or 2 hours. I also wanted to mention our sponsors, which are Daughters of Isis, Florida Nature Photos, Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio, Power New Media and Public Relations, Roundtree 7, Tarot and Stars, and the Hoodoo blog. You can see those mentioned right on our website at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. Up to a couple of weeks ago, we were found on Posteris, Unfortunately, Posteris will be going away permanently on April 30th, so now our new home is at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. You are listening to Starhawk's talk on March 7th at the Harvard Divinity School. It was called Permaculture and the Sacred, A Conversation with Starhawk. I'm going to go ahead and pick up where we left off. In the meantime, if you have any questions or you would like to speak on the air about something that you really want to talk about or get some airtime about, just go ahead and leave a note in the chat because I am monitoring it. And I will stop the presentation and you can go on. This program and all other programs through the Wise Women Media radio show are archived forever on Blog Talk Radio. You can go right to the website, as I said before, wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com, and you can click into any of the links and it'll take you right to the archived show. And let me remind everybody also on that blog that we are funded by our listeners. And there is a, it's like a graphic that has my picture. It says, GoFundMe. Donate, please donate to keep us on the air every week. No amount is too small. Dig deep and help us out so we can keep bringing you these shows. So let me go back to Starhawk's presentation. I hope you're enjoying this.
So that's a little taste of how permaculturalists look at patterns. Right. Permaculture is a wonderful thing, and so is technology when it works. There we go. So we begin with thoughtful, protracted observation, which means we start by looking at what's going on in the world around us. For me, this has become part of my deep spiritual practice. I used to do a lot of meditation that involved closing my eyes and focusing on my inner imagery or meditating on certain images of goddesses or stories or myths. I still do some of that, but my basic daily practice is to go outside and sit somewhere and open my eyes and listen and look and observe what is going on around me. We take nature as our model. This is a wonderful group in Portland called City Repair that transforms intersections into gathering spaces. We value diversity. think this is another one of those principles that applies deeply to social justice, because we understand that in nature, diversity brings resilience. You have a field of genetically engineered corn, all identical. You get a bug there. That bug is going to munch its way through all the corn. If you have a meadow or a prairie where you've got 400 different species in every square yard of that prairie, you get a bug or you get a disease and it's going to maybe munch one thing and then it's going to have a lot of difficulty finding the next thing it wants to munch on because there's so much diversity and so much resilience. And in human systems, we tend to think that diversity is a bad thing. If people are different, they must be dangerous or they must be lesser or whatever. If we could really understand that our human diversity is a great source of our creativity and our resilience. If you have a department that's all white people from upper class backgrounds, you're going to have a certain view of things that comes through. But if you open that up to diversity of gender, of race, of gender history, of orientation, of class, you're going to get people who look at the world in a wider variety of ways. Actually going to make your science, your scholarship, your whole endeavor far more intelligent, far more sophisticated, far more exciting. So the edge where two systems come together, again, becomes one of those creative places. The coughs and the clowns. And, you know, I often think of that, like, if you think about music, think about that creative edge where African music and European music come together, giving us jazz and blues and gospel and hip-hop and rock and roll and folk music and spirituals and so many different kinds of wonderful creative things that come out of an edge, out of it. So how do we get ourselves out of the mess we're in? We need to catch and store energy in renewable ways. And that starts with the sun's energy. That picture on the right is actually my place in the Casadero Hills on a rainy day where it doesn't look like it's capturing a lot of energy. But it does. And alternative energy renewables is not necessarily something people were doing it hundreds of years ago. In Holland, these are windmills that still function, grinding grain and peanut butter and pigments, the same mills that ground pigments for Rembrandt, still functioning. But it can be very new. And I think this is the path to creating a world of energy abundance for us all. And as well, there are those forms of energy, like human energy, that can be used. Parking lot in Amsterdam at the railway station. And I will say that today we were fed on wonderful sandwiches that were delivered by bicycle. Understanding that waste is a resource. To me, this is clue up to an economy that would actually function for us all in a world of diminishing natural resources. We have to understand how to use our waste as a resource. So here they're using cardboard for sheet mulch to help build soil. Composting. Any of you compost? I know here at Harvard they're composting. Composting not only is a good thing to do for helping your waste, but when you're composting, you're building healthy organic soil. That soil is full of carbon. And the world's soils have a huge carbon debt because of agriculture over time. There's been enormous carbon loss. There's a researcher called Dr. Ratan Lal at the University of Ohio who says that we have as much excess carbon in the atmosphere from the Dust Bowl in the 1930s as we do CO2 from every automobile ever. So that carbon hunger is actually good news for us because it offers us a pathway to sequestering carbon, to taking it out of the atmosphere and doing it in a way that's not only safe but has no downside. It's only going to help regenerate ecosystems, land systems, your garden, everything else. When you're making compost, when you're increasing that humus in the soil, humus is basically full of carbon and it's stable. It can last, molecule of humus can last up to 50 years. So when people start talking geoengineering and all that stuff, we don't need to be putting like mirrors in space or feeding the ocean with chemicals or all that crackpot stuff. What we need to be doing is massive soil building on massive scale, as well as that shift to alternatives, renewables, all of those things. And wouldn't it be exciting, you know, if our national dialogue, instead of being bogged down in all of the ridiculous stuff it is currently bogged down in, if we were having a dialogue that was saying something like, hey, everybody, yes, we have this huge crisis, and here's the things we could do about it. What if we all got together and started doing them as fast as we can and stopped doing the things that are destroying us and started to shift to doing those things? Wouldn't that be exciting? Kind of like, you know, Mickey and Judy, we could, you know, put a show on in our own backyard. Yeah. Well, we could save the world in our own back gardens, you know, and start with compost. And even things like living machines, this is actually a sewage treatment plant in Scotland that handles the sewage for a community of 350 people, all using biological methods. And it runs through these different tanks full of algae and full of different kinds of water plants and fish and stuff. It comes out at the end as pure drinking water quality water, and in the meantime produces plants that they actually take, you know, flowers and stuff they take to the market. So that's about stacking functions, making sure that, just like with that rose, that everything in your system serves multiple functions. On the left, that is my backyard in San Francisco. It's a labyrinth that also works as a patio. On the right, there's a rain catchment system that also works as a sculpture. And I think, again, for me, one of the places where the sacred comes together with this is to understand that beauty is something that doesn't have to be relegated to museums. It could be, you know, it could be embedded in all of the things that we create. And in fact, it could actually, I think it's a good ecological test. You know, if you are creating something that is helpful to the world, it usually is beautiful. It has its own integrity, its own function. If you're creating something that's really ugly, it's probably not doing good for the world. So permaculture likes to create things like food forests, which again are a food growing system that mimics the forest, where every element in it, from the trees to the shrubs to the vines to the undergrowth, has some sort of useful or helpful function. And this is corn growing in the middle of the food forest at the Agroforestry Research Trust in Devon. One of my favorite plants, the elderberry, which is also sacred tree in European tradition. In Germany, it's called the Holunder, the Frau Holle, who was the goddess of winter, of snow, tapping. You can, here you can tap maples for syrup. You can also tap pines for turpentine. Water landscape in a place called Tamara Eco Village in Portugal. Dry land system. That's Bill Mollison, but it's kind of hard to see in the middle there. But it's a little dark from your point of view. But this is Dadia Lawton in Jeff Lutton's farm, which is right next to the Dead Sea in Jordan, where they've taken this land with absolutely barren white soil and are turning it into a productive ecosystem. And there's a wonderful video you can Google called Greening the Desert, where Jeff Lawton talks about one of his projects that's really one of the most inspirational things I've seen. So to do all the positive things that we need to do, we can employ those principles. We can employ the principle of relative location by bringing things back, by localizing, by creating systems that meet our needs for food and for other things that don't have to be transported thousands of miles. By rerouting our enterprises in communities and by shifting their goals and their purposes so that they are, you know, where the purpose is no longer to accumulate, again, these abstract numbers on someone's balance sheet, but where the purpose of something should be to create something that meets real needs and provides lives of dignity and fulfillment for the people who do the work while regenerating the environment around. Imagine if that was our criteria for success instead of, you know, short-term, quarter-term profits on the balance sheet, how things would shift and change and turn around in the country and the world. To get there, there are some big systems that need to be considered. And one of them has been the whole system of globalization that allows corporations to roam the world in search of the biggest profits, the most lax environment standards, the most lax safety standards. So I've been involved for many years in work, you know, trying to work against some of these big systems like the WTO, the World Trade Organization, the FTA, and how do we apply permaculture principles to that unfortunate but necessary work of standing up and saying no to many of these systems. Well, these are a few pictures from the WTO protests in 2003 in Cancun, where we decided, as part of our no, we wanted to embody a yes. What are we saying yes to if we're saying no to this big system of globalization? So we came and did a whole permaculture installation there that began with information. We set up a washing station and rain catchment in gray water for the encampment of campesinos that had come to protest. And so we had this wonderful little thing that was kind of like one of those old Rube Goldberg designs where caught water off a tent, you know, the water came down, was collected in a barrel. We had a little hand pump with a little wheel on it that moved the water up. The water came down into those little orange things, which are sinks, and then went through the gray water system. And then we'd been there longer than a few weeks. That gray water system could have gone out into a garden and grown food. And I remember setting it up the first day, and a woman came, one of the campesina women from one of the villages came and came over and was looking at that pump, and she turned to me and she said in Spanish, "You know, in my village, we don't have any running water. Pump costs thousands of dollars. We don't have the money for that. This would work." And so, again, it served many functions. It created a model of a system that says, hey, you know what? To meet people's needs, you don't necessarily need $100 million from the World Bank. You know, you don't need a big, huge hydroelectric dam. You know, you could build a little system like this out of garbage, and it can create something that can meet those needs in a way that's elegant and efficient and that creates some real abundance. And it showed people possibilities because there were 1,000 campesinos that came down and 1,000 students to protest, so people got exposed to these ideas. It created something photogenic for the media to focus on, especially in the run-up to the protests. And that was good because they had started by calling us globalophobicos, those rate of globalization. And by the time we were gone, the media was talking about global propositos, those who are proposing a different kind of globalization. And, of course, there were many demonstrations and protests. There was a Korean farmer who actually committed suicide at the barricades, and his protest against the farmer suicides that were going on around the world because of globalization. It's like an epidemic of farmer suicide. It's a very powerful act that deeply affected the negotiations that were there. We had wonderful moments, too, where a bunch of us all dressed up as tourists got into the zone where the WTO was meeting and managed to block the streets as they were all out for dinner. We had a bunch of trees that our friends were able to somehow carry in that we could put out in the middle of the street and in a whole sacred circle with seeds and did a spiral dance out there. And the police just kind of didn't know what to do. And at the end, I mean, I remember one of the delegates came out and told my friend Rodrigo, I've been in there for 3 days. What's going on there? It's bullshit. I don't care. I'm joining the dance. So we were also able to employ another permaculture slogan or principle, which is the problem being the barricades. On the last day of the demonstrations, people got together, the women went first to cut them apart. And then the Koreans had woven these beautiful ropes out of many strands of smaller ropes. They tied them together, and people pulled the barricades down. I always think those ropes represent to me some of the power of community, because each little strand itself is very weak, but twined together and twisted together, they became very powerful, strong cords of connection. So the problem being those barricades is also the solution. Some of the group took the barricades after we pulled them down, took them over behind us, and set them up as new barricades to keep the police from coming and overwhelming us. And people were able to have a big, huge rally. And in the end, the WTO negotiations fell apart at that meeting. That was the meeting where they were attempting to come up with agricultural agreements that would have had a huge impact. And the Global South, partly encouraged by some of our actions, people walked out of the meeting and the negotiations fell apart. And now after those many years of protests, the WTO basically is somewhat dead in the water. It doesn't mean globalization has ended, but it does mean that it was a big setback for where it might have been had we not done all of that protesting. And for me, again, bringing in the permaculture and the principle of the sacred, those protests I felt were even more effective because we weren't just saying what we were against. We were also coming with a vision of what it was that we were for. So one final principle, there are many, many principles, but the final one I want to talk about, the principle I call feed what you want to grow. That oftentimes, in conventional agriculture, you see a bug or a pest or something, you say, nuke it, kill it, pour poison all over it. In our foreign policies, we see a terrorist, like, kill him, bomb Iran to the ground, whatever it is. In permaculture, you see a pest, and you say, that's a piece of information. That's telling us something is out of balance. What can I bring in that will help you? Check. How do I create conditions in the garden that are going to favor the things I want and discourage the things that I don't want? Now imagine if we applied that to our foreign policy. Instead of saying, terrorists, kill them, what if we said, terrorists, that's information. What are the conditions that are creating, that are favoring this kind of behavior? how do we actually favor the things that are going to shift that behavior rather than trying to kill the enemy? Because killing the bugs always creates resistance. And you know, whether it's antibiotics used on everything or whether it's, you know, pesticides poured on your cornfield, the things that you don't want somehow always are going to reproduce more effectively. Because by killing everything, you're actually creating conditions that favor often the path of the disease. So instead of doing that, we thought about it. We might be able to say, what are the conditions that are actually creating this wave of anger and bitterness and hatred? How do we shift that? We shift that to conditions that favor justice and favor connection. We might be able to make the world a much safer and more secure place than it is right now. And without having to kill so many people and destroy so much in order to do it. And the same, I think, applies, you know, if we want kids in the inner city to be healthy, if we want to undo poverty, we have to feed what we want to grow. We have to create conditions. If we want people to eat healthily, like this is a project I work with in Bayview Hunters Point in the lowest income neighborhood, which is also pretty much a food desert, a place where fresh organic food is really hard to find. And I work with a project there called Girls 2000 that's run by an organization called Hunters Point Family, where young girls who are high school and middle school age work in an urban garden, an urban farm, get paid a stipend for doing it, learn about farming and gardening, and also we have slowly over time gotten them to actually eat some of the food. So this young girl got very excited with this calva lily and wanted to fill it up with water and drink from it. So feeding, you know, what you want to grow in kids, in relationships, thinking about what are the conditions that are actually going to favor what we want to have. Sometimes kind of risky to take a bite of that unknown thing. But showing people how to actually grow and nurture things, how to prune, how to plant seeds. There are some of the older kids in one of our job training programs. Then you can start to grow that sense of wonder and joy and connection to the natural world that we need if we're going to actually create systems that can bring us back. So I want to just finish with some pictures from City Repair in Portland, because I think they're doing some of the most amazing imaginative out-of-the-box work. They take intersections where people have, they believe our cities are designed to separate us and not to bring us together, and they paint mandalas and they turn them into gathering places. This is their T-horse bus with wings that create like shelter for serving tea and having gatherings. Gathering at Sunnyside Piazza, showed you earlier. And this is a wonderful labyrinth that people painted in the middle of the street to walk. Spiral dance. Street parties, gatherings. Way of like physically transforming the spaces that are, you know, kind of waste spaces into sacred spaces. Like connection. So, what world do we want? That one, or these are Tasmanian rainforests, just started. Destruction of Hurricane Katrina, or the regeneration. An area in New Orleans that we helped to plant sunflowers to extract some of the toxins from the soil and help regenerate the land. When we do that, we can create again a world of wonder. Yeah. Yeah, look at a butterfly, joy in life. So want to finish by saying I believe all of you are really important. We are here for a reason. And I believe, actually, that all of us are here at this time because we all have a role to play in making this transition. Here at Harvard, people always say Harvard is the best and the brightest. That's a position of incredible privilege. And I think the best use of privilege is not to agonize about it, guilty about it, but to say, wow, what a wonderful thing. How do I take this and use this in the service of greater justice, greater care for the earth, greater care for people? Those of you who are involved in the Divinity School who will go out and be spiritual leaders in your community have a great opportunity to help people to see, again, that while we face these tremendous challenges, we also have tremendous resources. We also have tremendous allies. We also have a tremendous opportunity. The problem is the solution. And the problem of our system becoming utterly unsustainable is the solution to creating a new system that can bring us into harmony with the earth. And that ultimately will have more joy in it, more beauty, more justice, more abundance, more true happiness for everyone who's here. So I believe that this is a really wonderful time to be alive. And I'm grateful for this opportunity to come to be here. And I am really excited and thinking about what you all are going to go out and
did her thesis on how do we bring the sacred back into our food. And so that was something really interesting. She talked about like all the pesticides and, you know, the way all the food is made and, you know, and that type of thing. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that as it relates to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the core of most religions, I mean, certainly in Judaism even, let alone paganism, it's all about the food, really. You know, read the Bible. It's all about the food. It's all about, you know, how the food is grown, and all of those things were originally considered sacred activities. In indigenous cultures, they still are. And, you know, I think what's happened to our food supply is that we have lost that. It has become this industrial model where, again, the purpose is not just really to grow food, but food is sort of incidental to growing profits. In the name of that, we do things that are really nuts, you know, pouring poisons all over the stuff we're going to eat, allowing corporations to make money by genetically engineering things, which more and more research is showing has tremendously negative effects on our health, environmental health, ecological health, all that stuff. So I believe, for me, growing food is part of my spiritual practice. And I know not everyone's in a position where you can grow a garden or even participate in one. But if you can, you can even grow a pot of mint on your balcony, you know, and eat something that you have that relationship with because you've nurtured it and you've put something of yourself into it. I believe we actually get a different kind of nourishment from that than from food. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I think one of the opportunities that we have hearing you at Harvard Divinity School is to look at the edge, and I love how you put that, of interfaith work. And the kinds of, there are so many similarities between, you know, you've been doing this work for so long and for so many decades. Some of it is emerging in Judaism and is emerging in Christianity. You know, I think I was just struck by the similarity of what you've said to what my rabbinic mentor says about, you know, an organic Torah, about patterns and all of that stuff that is so beautiful. And it occurs to me that, you know, we had a Jewish food conference where we were talking about this stuff, but there wasn't anybody there who wasn't, you know, in the Jewish community in some way. And so how can we become better at doing this work together rather than separately? And how can we let the edge of interfaith encounter inform how we do this kind of work? Is there any way the work could be different or enriched by, you know, better incorporating that edge of constant interfaith encounter?
So in Judaism, there's a concept called eco-kosher. Kosher isn't, you know, it is about following all the laws, which themselves originally had ecological value. Probably many still do. But about thinking about the way something is grown and the way it's raised has an ethical and a sacred aspect in terms of what you want to eat and willing to eat. And I think that's a concept that would be interesting to spread in an interfaith context. Because it's not just Judaism that has laws about food, where your food is an important aspect of the religion. I also think that there are many different traditions that are starting to create green congregations. Say, okay, how do we take our building, our physical plant, can we grow a garden here? Can we, can we make it less energy intensive, all of those things, how do we green it? You know, wouldn't it be wonderful to have an interfaith effort to look at the different churches and synagogues and places, to have interfaith gardening days, interfaith gardening feasts, around, again, that real physical connection to the earth. and I think the kind of richness and diversity and edge of interfaith work often is a place where people do get insights into your own tradition, insights into different possibilities from this connection. So helping people to understand that also as an ecological, as a permacultural edge, I think might help reinforce that sense of the value. I wonder if there are women who have questions. Yeah.
I'm a study student, and I would love some practical suggestions on, you know, so Boston's very walkable and pedestrian-friendly, and so is San Francisco. So when I think about city planning, I like to think of ideas to bridge people and connect people together, but some cities are just so massive that it's very hard to do that, so they have these clusters. So I'm wondering if you can offer some ideas or things that you've seen successful projects promoting spirituality, connection, sustainability, promoting efforts.
Yeah, the city repair stuff is actually Portland, Oregon, which is possible is even more out there and eco-friendly than San Francisco. But I think that there is a mayor's conference on sustainability that a lot of mayors around the country are involved in. I'm not sure about Boston, but you know, they have been doing a lot of, you know, the work that's so frustrating on the national and international level has been moving ahead a lot on the local level. I think Boston has a huge interest in climate change. Because I'll tell you something, every time I fly in, you know, which is probably a climate change sin, but I haven't figured out how not to do it yet, but look down and see how close a lot of Boston is to sea level, you know, a lot of Boston is not going to be here if the oceans rise 20 feet. So that's a huge reason for Boston to be concerned about this issue and to be taking action around this issue. I think Boston also has a lot of stuff in place that, you know, when you look at the list of what are the most energy efficient cities in the country, actually, New York City often comes out close to the top, and that's because a lot of people don't drive in New York City. They have great transportation, public transportation in New York City, because of the density, and Boston shares many of those same characteristics. There's a movement called the Transition Movement, Transition USA, that has been organizing people around small towns and neighborhoods to get together with your neighbors and say, okay, how do we take the resources we have now to make the transition to the next phase? And organizing something like that, I think, can be really helpful, you know, starting in those little clusters in those little neighborhoods, getting people to take responsibility for their neighborhood, and then move from the neighborhood into how do we take responsibility for the larger city as a whole.
I will say I don't know whether I was sitting into male or female. I'm a trans man. I'm a little bit of both. So anyway, my question is, I was actually starting to learn about permaculture when I went home for Christmas. And my siblings and family are very much into it and are doing stuff on their property, et cetera. They're also right-wing Republican, Latin Rite Catholic. So on the other side to it, what they're doing in permaculture does not translate into what I know of your social vision for the world. And so I'm wondering what critical tools that you're taking, not just being involved in permaculture, but the critical tools you're using to extract out of that a certain social vision.
I mean, I will say I have a great friend who works on a pretty big scale with cities and corporations trying to get them to green themselves. And I was talking with him, we're making a movie of the fifth sacred thing, of my novel, which is set in the future. And, you know, we were having a discussion about it. He was saying, you've got to make sure the bad guys are ecologically responsible. You know, because we're not going to make this work if it's just the good guys. You know, we've got to have the corporations. We've got to have the right-wing Republicans on board. In fact, when the right-wing Republicans are on board with something like permaculture, that is a really hopeful step.
Right.
And it also doesn't mean that they're going to be on board with feminism or with, you know, other kinds of social justice, no matter how logical that seems to me or to us. But for me, I think in the permaculture movement, I would say the right-wing Republicans are probably the minority, but they are there, right? There are related movements like the holistic management ranching and grazing movement, which is tremendously exciting and probably a real key to carbon sequestration worldwide. And Charles Williams, who co-teaches a lot of permaculture with me and also manages my land, he went and took the holistic management course so we could be doing rotational grazing. And New Mexico, he came back. How was the course? He said, well, aside from me, everyone else was a right-wing Republican rancher from Texas. Great. Because those are, when you get those people to change the world can change. And I think also, it is my hope and belief that as people start practicing permaculture, it does start to shift your thinking. It may not immediately, obviously, make that shift, but within the movement, it gives you an opportunity for conversation and an opportunity to meet those people you might not otherwise meet up with or connect up with. And to have those conversations where gradually people can kind of come to understand that there might be other ways. They've been conditioned to look at the world. And thank you all.
Thank you all for listening to the Wise Women Media Radio Show. That audio feed was just a really amazing and profound presentation by Starhawk at the Harvard Divinity School that took place again on March 7th. Permaculture and the Sacred, a conversation with Starhawk. Hope you enjoyed it. Please catch us next week at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time next Friday. And we're going to close with a song by Tina Malia called Heal This Land. See you next week. Thanks. Understand, let us walk together. Take my hand and we will heal.